Well, number one, Andy does a much better job of that than I do. But I have at least been able to help him out a little bit in that capacity today. For that, I'm grateful. First off, if you don't know me, he made me sound way more important than I am. Way more. So the only thing that I can hope for at the 2:15 hour is, as I told a couple of them before, I don't even want to try to keep people awake. I just want to be soothing so that we'll get something out of the time that we spend together. You know what? I don't know if I'm going to be pushing the time or filling the time. I'm going to do neither. One of the first things I ever learned in preaching was that you preach till you're through, and when you're done, you quit. And that's an important lesson to learn. I did hear a story one time about a fellow who was in Scotland, and he was passing by a building, and one man exited, and you know, that's the thing, you never see one person come out, there's always a group of them. He was not Scottish, but he said to the gentleman, he said, "Well, are they done in church?" And he said, he looked at him like he didn't understand the question. He said, is the preacher done? He said, "Aye, he's done, but he went a stop." So I wouldn't want to be in that category. The 83rd Psalm. The 83rd Psalm is the last of the section attributed to Asaph. But the question of whether or not this was the original Asaph is an open question. Now, maybe the question should be more like, or phrased more like this. Is it Asaph or is it people connected with him? By the original Asaph, we mean the man that David appointed to be a leader among the Levites for temple service. And a number of these psalms are accredited to him. Now, why would we not immediately accept the inscription as it stands and say, yes, this is the psalm of the original Asaph? And the reason is because the situation as it's described here in Psalm 83 bears no resemblance to anything that would have taken place during the life of either David or Solomon. On the other hand, there was a situation that took place in the mid-9th century during the reign of Jehoshaphat. And it is strikingly similar. In fact, Adam Clark listed three major similarities here. Number one, that the coalition was one of the Ammonites and Moabites that was later joined by the Edomites. And then the third one, those are two characteristics. The third one were the minor nations that also joined in, being from beyond the sea, and that's evidently the Dead Sea. So, what we presume is this, that the psalm, what is meant by the psalm of Asaph is the family of Asaph, because when we go to 2 Chronicles 20, what we learn there is that there's a man by the name of Yahaziel, and he plays a major role in this circumstance involving Jehoshaphat. And what happened was this. Jehoshaphat was being faced with an overwhelming difficulty, one that he fully believed threatened Judah's very existence. And what he did, Matt talked about this oddly enough this morning, but what he did was he called the people together, they made the sacrifices, they prayed, and he received a message from Yahaziel. And the message was, you have no need to worry about this battle. In fact, I just want your people to see my victory. Now, it may be of interest to you, Yahaziel was a descendant of Asaph. And so it may well have been that he was the one who wrote it, and what is meant by that inscription is the family of Asaph, and maybe the other psalms as well, or some of them, or maybe even all of them, are rightly attributed to the clan of Asaph rather than the original Asaph himself. But what's happening when you compare those two texts, that is Psalm 83 and 2 Chronicles 20, is extraordinary, because on the one hand, what you have are the people appealing to God for help. Now, and this is important that you get this. It is either written before the battle that never was, or it is at least written from the standpoint of being before the battle. So, when this is written, there is no earthly assurance that they're even going to survive. And I think that's important to understanding what's written there. I think it's likely it actually was written before. But when you compare the two, on the one, you have the appeal to God for help, and then the other, you have the record of exactly what happened. And so Jehoshaphat, in an extraordinary act of faith, did something that was incredible. He arranged his army so that they were led by singers and preachers. It was an army with unarmed point men. And their sole purpose was to witness God's victory. By the time that they got there, God had, by unspecified means, influenced these nations to quarrel. And the quarrel, I suppose, turned into battle. And by the time the Israelites or the Judahites had gotten there, they had basically all killed one another. And the only thing that remained was for the people to celebrate God's great victory and to gather up the spoil. And it's kind of incredible, isn't it? Now, the psalm itself, as we return to that, it is important for us to get that background information, or much of what we study over the next few minutes, I don't think makes as much sense. But the psalm itself is very well arranged. It begins with an introduction verse, and there's a conclusion verse, and I think there's much that these two verses have to do with one another. The last verse kind of resolves the first one and the question that it asked. And in between, you have four sections of material that we're going to talk about. That first verse in question reads, "Keep not thou silence, O God. Hold not thy peace, and be not still, O God." And then all the way down in verse 18, see, the question is implied. Why are you keeping still, Lord? Why aren't you doing something about this? And then down in verse 18, it's resolved by saying that men may know that thou whose name alone is Jehovah art the most high over all the earth. Now, the first verse, I would argue, is an introduction, but it also is certainly included in the first section as it sets the tone for it as well. That first section, verses 1 through 8, I decided to title Sound the Battle Cry. Be realistic. Our topic is when confronted by the God haters. I want to read you that section, and then I want to tell you an absurdly long story. But it's one that I feel compelled to tell you, and I think will help us to understand this a little better. But let's read those eight verses. Keep not thou silence, O God. Hold not thy peace, and be not still, O God. For lo, thine enemies make a tumult, and they that hate thee have lifted up the head. They have taken crafty countenance against thy people and consulted against thy hidden ones. They have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. For they have consulted together with one consent. They are confederate against thee. the tabernacles of Edom and Ishmaelites, of Moab and the Hagarines, Gebal, Ammon, Amalek, the Philistines with the inhabitants of Tyre. Ashur is also joined with them. They have helped, or helped, we'd say, the children of Lot. The God-haters. The God-haters are alive and well. I don't think I ever really understood that clearly until the summer of 2010. I don't remember exactly how I ended up in an online debate with, I don't remember how many atheists and skeptics there were, but more than one. It was not one-on-one. Now, I learned two things from this experience that kind of stretched on for several weeks. Number one, if you ever have the opportunity to get in an online internet debate, don't. That's the first lesson. And if you maybe lesson number two, I should just say consult lesson number one. Just don't do it. But it was a mind-boggling experience. Why? I mean, I knew the attitudes of some of the infamous atheists, the Dawkins and the Harrises of the world. I knew all that. But in my naivete, I thought, surely I will encounter some atheists and skeptics who just simply have never seen the evidence for God and have never given sufficient reason to know that there is a God and to know that the Bible is reliable. No, that wasn't what was going on. It didn't matter. I mean, I found myself answering questions, answering. I couldn't keep up with all, and they never had to answer any questions. And there was no respect of differing thought. It was only contempt. If I would dismantle an argument, no concession was ever made. You would just sort of congratulate yourself and move on. And I thought at the very least I might find with these anonymous folks, and I think that's part of the problem. I've noticed that if you're speaking to a computer by means of keyboard, you can convince yourself that the ridiculous argument you've just made isn't so ridiculous after all. And I'm not sure why that is, but I've noticed that it is. But I thought, at the very least, we could be gentlemanly and behave toward one another in using good men. No, none of that. Every argument was evaluated, and I mean, I know I'm painting with a broad brush here, but I've only got a little bit of time, and I could go on and on and on and on about this, and it won't do us any good. I'm making the point this way, and it's okay. But every argument was examined purely upon their fondness for what it taught. And all of this that I'm describing to you, to me, said volumes anyway. Because if one has the truth, he doesn't have to resort to such tactics. If one has the truth, he can afford to be kind and patient. You know, I also found myself doing this, and I finally got to a point where I thought, this is absurd, I'm not doing it anymore. If I said something that they're unfamiliar with, their reaction is, you have to document that. They said something I wasn't familiar with, well, you're an ignoramus, you know. Nothing, no level playing field at all. I was used to reading about these discussions from my youth, and I even cite in the book for you, I think it's a kind of unusual citation, but I still think it holds water. Isaac Asimov, there was an old magazine back in the 70s called Omni Magazine They had a debate on the existence of God with Isaac Asimov, famous science fiction novelist and a theistic scientist. And what was interesting was it was done in a very respectful manner. Here are two intellects, we're going to be respectful to one another. Asimov even had people debate the existence of God in one of his novels. And what I found interesting about that was he's the creator of the characters, you see. He can make them do anything that he wants them to do. He could have made the one who believed in God a complete dolt who made stupid arguments. He didn't do that. I guess he wanted the people to see, here's what is actually being said in this discussion. But I learned these are not your father's atheists, and we're not in Kansas anymore. And finally, because I'm not that bright, it takes a long time for me to see the light sometimes. But finally, it clicked on, and I realized something. These people that I'm trying to reason with are not, and not all of them were atheistic. Some of them were just skeptics of the Bible, okay? Whatever. But the reason they were where they were was not because they didn't have the evidence to believe in God. The reason they were where they were was because they hated God's guts. I'm serious. They hate his guts. How dare he have the audacity to issue commands to me? That was their attitude. It's not a matter of evidence. It's a matter of despising him and his standards. Oh yes, the God haters are alive and well. To the uninitiated and naive, it's hard to imagine the level of viciousness and vehemence that you'll encounter, at least in some arenas. You need to know. It really shouldn't surprise us, though, should it? Didn't Jesus promise his disciples, "You'll be hated of all men for my sake"? Or John, years and years later, in 1 John 3:13, he says, "Marvel not, my brethren, if the world hate you." And I have to smile every time I see this because, and I'm not pointing fingers, this is me too, but what brethren do, you know, they'll be surprised. I can't believe it. They hated us because well, John just said, "Marvel not," you know, and here we are marveling. I can't believe it. John said, "Marvel not." It is going to happen. Absolutely, it's going to happen. But I guess the real question, and it is handled in this psalm, is why does it happen exactly? Why do people hate God? Why do people hate righteousness and by extension hate the God of righteousness? Why is that? And I think there's a reason. And I believe that it's actually addressed in the text. I want you to take note of verse 2. When he says, "Thine enemies make a tumult, and they that hate thee have lifted up the head." What's that mean? Well, typically lifting up the head is an attitude of pride. You know, there's something about the nature of Israel itself in the Old Testament, and I'm not going to keep jumping back and forth between Israel and Judah. I'm just going to stay with Israel from this point on. You know that if I'm talking about Judah, that's who I mean. But anyway, Israel in the Old Testament and the hatred that sometimes was coming her way. I mean, look at this thing. This is a vast alliance of a lot of different people. And they're all coming after this one nation. Now, you could understand such an alliance late, you know, back maybe in the days of Solomon when they were an overwhelming power, but that's not the case here. This is after the division, and again, it's just the two tribes, basically. So where did all this come from? I think that we sometimes underestimate what the ancient nations knew and understood about God's people. I mean, we might come to the conclusion, most of us know, I mean, these were God's chosen people, but the question might be asked from somebody, well, isn't that just pretty much what everybody thought back in those days? I mean, if you went over to Ammon, wouldn't they have said, no, we're the people of God, or Moab, no, we're the people of God. Isn't that just the way people, no, it really wasn't. At least not like Israel. What I'm telling you is there is sufficient evidence in the Old Testament to demonstrate to me that there was at least an inkling among the other nations that this claim had something real behind it. It wasn't just patriotism that caused them to say, we are the people of God. I'm telling you, enough had happened that people knew there was something to it. Oh, not all of them, of course. But the ones that were lifted up with pride, they hated it. It might explain this attitude, why some things happened throughout history as they did. Why that through the centuries there has been this long and awful tradition of Jew hatred. You know, you listen to some people, they would argue that the Holocaust came as a result of Bible prophecy, and I don't believe that. However, there has certainly been an awful echo through the centuries of things that had their root this far back. If you listen to the premillennialists, especially with Psalm 83, they'll try to tell you that what this is about, this is actually predicting today, you know, and here we have Israel in the Middle East surrounded by people who don't particularly even like the fact that Israel exists. And so what Psalm 83 is about to them is all these nations and their opposition to 1947 Israel. And that isn't so. But adding fuel to the fire was the discovery in 2006 of a 1,200-year-old manuscript in Ireland. It was found in a bog, and as luck or providence would have it, it was open to Psalm 83. And so the premillennialists at that point began jumping up and down and breathlessly exclaim, see there, it's about Israel today. God made sure that we found it, and it was open just to the right page. No, it's not about Israel today. I'm glad we found it, but no. It is not about Israel today. But this idea of the pride of people who know they're wrong is an important one for us to understand. Allow me to illustrate. Many years ago, I had a Mormon boy come to my house, and I really wanted to talk to him. Well, two. They're always coming in twos. I didn't have time to talk to him, but I still remember his opening line. He said, sir, we'd like to take a few minutes and talk to you about the one true church, the Mormon church. And after I explained to him I really had to be somewhere and that I wasn't brushing him off, I'd like to talk to you, but I honestly don't have time. I went and got in the car, and all of a sudden it hit me. I thought that line was supposed to make people furious. What do you mean? I mean, there are people in the church that tell us that's the awfulest thing you could ever say to somebody, that God has one true church. I guess we're supposed to keep it secret from them for a while. Now, here's my question. Why didn't that make me angry? And I promise you, it didn't even make me a little hot under the collar. It didn't. Well, the reason it didn't make me angry is, number one, I knew it wasn't true, but I knew he thought it was. Why would that make me angry? I knew it wasn't true, but I knew that he thought I needed to hear it. And he was trying to give me something that he thought would help me. You know what would really have to be in place before before I were to get good and mad over that? There'd have to be a part of me just wondering, maybe, is what he says true? And see, that's what happens with denominational folks in the church. Because of the exclusive nature of the Church of Christ, there are some people that are going to get furious over the idea, what, you're saying I'm not saved? What? How could that be? Well, the reason really is that's a prideful response if there's part of you that's worried that it just might be true. And so here's the people of God, and God's saying, these are my people. And so when all the factors are just right, you form this alliance. It's not a self-defense alliance against a military juggernaut, but it was loosely formed and fortunately just as easily destroyed. So they made all these plans, but they came to naught. Micah chapter 2 and verse 1. Woe to them that devise iniquity, that work evil upon their beds. When the morning is light, they shall practice it because the power is in their hands. All right, let's move along to the next section, 9 through 12. 9 through 12, it reads, do unto them as unto the Midianites, as to Sisera, as to Jabin, at the brook of Kishon, which perished at Endor, they became as dung for the earth. Make their nobles like Oreb and like Zeb. Who names their kid Zeb? Everybody's got a Z here, I guess, because there's three of them. Zeb and all their princes as Zeba and as Zalmunna, who said, let us take to ourselves the houses of God in possession. Faith is the victory, is the song. The admonition is to remember. It's interesting to think about how many times the people of God called upon God to remember, even as Nehemiah did in Nehemiah chapter 1 and verses 8 and 9, in the depths of the situation that he found himself in. He called upon God. He said, remember what you promised through your servant Moses, that after this time of scattering, you will gather your people together. And the question is, did God remember? Well, sure, God remembered these things as facts. In cases like this, in cases like he is calling on here, and he's bringing up these things of the past, you see, the Midianites in the days of Gideon, and the Canaanites in the days of Deborah and Barak in chapters 4 and 5. But what he's saying is, Lord, you have done this in the past. We have faith in your capability to do this again. So faith is a victory. Lord, will you remember? And to remember is to do something almost every time in the Bible. Rarely, if ever, just simply means to recall a fact. So what had happened? There are two principles that I'm convinced, anyway, are governing the reason that he calls these particular incidents to mind. Number one, they involve many of the same nations that are currently hostile toward God's people. But number two was the method that God used back in the book of Judges. Let's do a quick review of that. Let's begin with Sisera, or Jabin rather, the king, and Sisera the general. Now, what happened was they come against the people of God. Sisera has at his command 900 iron chariots, and iron chariots are roughly equivalent to having a tank in modern warfare. And I suppose that the foot soldier, the infantry man, would have about as good a success ratio against the ancient iron chariot as a modern one would have against a tank. Nonetheless, these 900 iron chariots are rendered not only useless, but less than useless. Why? We don't get many details about it in the initial battle report. But in the second chapter, that is Judges chapter 5, you read the song of Deborah that was written to celebrate that victory. And what you notice in verses 4 and 5 is she begins to make allusions to a rainstorm. And down in verse 21, she gets very specific. She says, there was a torrent that swept down the Kishon. So because the chariots were trying to fight in mud, evidently, they were rendered useless, and as I said, less than useless. In fact, if you were smart at that point, your best bet was to abandon the chariot and run as fast as your legs would take you, because you are just a sitting duck. Now, here's a question for you. Did Jabin and Sisera know what would likely happen to a chariot if it rained? Well, sure they did. They'd done this. This wasn't their first rodeo. So we conclude from that it had to be a completely unexpected rainstorm that caught them by surprise. Otherwise, you're in the poor position of saying God's victory, and it is God's victory over the Canaanites in this case, was attributed either to Canaanite lack of foresight or blind luck, and it was neither of those. So who gave him the battle? Who gave him the victory? Well, God did. Oh, by miracle. No. Whoa, no. Rainstorm isn't a miracle. God sent the rainstorm, but that's no miracle. We're not talking about the walls of Jericho falling. We're not talking about the sun standing still or a selective hailstorm that targets one side and misses the other. We're not talking about a guy who kills lions unarmed or kills entire armies single-handedly. It was a rainstorm. But it was God's rainstorm. You ever pray for rain? Does God send rain when we pray sometimes? In the second incident, we have Gideon and the Midianites. Now, here's what's interesting about it, and you need to read it carefully to verify what I'm telling you is true. With the exception of how God revealed certain things in this story, Gideon defeated the Midianites also without the assistance of a miracle. In fact, God said that very thing to him when he originally called him. Gideon's protesting, I'm nothing, I'm tiny fellow from this tiny tribe, and and God said, do this in this might of yours. And I suppose Gideon's thoughts went something like this. I'm not sure exactly what he has reference to, but he has a plan and I'm going to follow it. And that's what happened. So initially, Gideon tears down the altar built to Baal and kind of gets people excited about the possibility with regard to the Midianites. And by the time this account is done, he has with 300 men beaten and mostly killed an army of Midianites that looked like just stretched from one side of the horizon to the other. You say, well, that had to be a miracle. Well, no, really it wasn't. The Bible is very explicit about each thing that happens. By the time it's done, by the way, this victory so energized the people of God that at the end of the hostilities, the tribes are actually arguing over who got to participate more. So it had totally changed the landscape. But here's the point of all this. The point is what God is able to do without resorting to miracles, which ought to say something to you and me about the things that are opposing us today, God haters or not. What God is able to do without miracles. What does he expect of his people? He expects them to call upon him and to ask for that intervention. I need to move on. If I'm not careful, I'm going to run over, and I certainly don't want to do that at this hour. So let's talk about the third section. In the third section, that is verses 13 through 15, it's a brief section. Our God is able to deliver. He's reliable is the word. Oh my God, make them like a wheel, as a stubble before the wind. As the fire burneth the wood, and as the flame setteth the mountains on fire, so persecute them with thy tempest, and make them afraid with thy storm. He is able to deliver. Now in the past section we were talking about what God was able to do in the past. Now in this section we're talking about applying that to the future. If you read from the New King James, it reads regarding verse 3, something that is stubble or some words that affect. The old King James that I read from makes that a wheel. I found it interesting. Some commentators make that a tumbleweed, as does at least one version of the Old Testament, and I really think that's the idea. If you read it that way, I think it makes a lot of sense. Oh my God, make them like a tumbleweed. Well, how so? What's the idea? The idea is that in the midst of all this pride, really, you're just going to be driven before the storm of God. If you manage to survive being kindling, which tumbleweeds would make for pretty good kindling, you're still just going to be driven by the power of God. Why is it important to know that? Because we as Christians err more often than I would like to admit regarding what constitutes defeat and victory on the political landscape. It's not been a very good few years for us, has it? At least not if you're judging power by men's standards and victory by men's standards. It's easy to forget. There is a God in heaven who is reliable. The book includes a quote from the gazillionaire Tim Gill. He is the LGBTQRSTUVWXYZ. I don't know how many more letters they're going to appropriate. But he's the activist, and he has been insanely successful at his insanity. And the statement that caught my eye most recently was when he said, "We are going to go into the hardest states," places like this, I assume. This is him speaking, "We are going to punish the wicked." Now, let that sink in. The absurd use of the word wicked, meaning anybody who dares agree with God. You're the wicked. We're going to punish you. What do you think of that? Well, I know what you think of it on the surface, but have you given that any thought, really? Like I said, wins have been few and far between. That is, if you're counting things the way some of us count them, maybe we should learn to think more like Jonathan before he attacked a Philistine garrison single-handedly. He said, "There is no restraint with the Lord to bring victory with many or a few." Maybe we need to learn from that. No, I realize by earthly standards, the wins have been few and far between, but I'm here to tell you this afternoon, God's still enthroned. God's still exactly where He's always been and where He always will be. Now, if you're going to fight on earthly terms and to find victory by earthly terms as well, we are losing big time. But God's given us the word. In Jeremiah chapter 5 and verse 14, the Lord told Jeremiah, "I will make, because you have this word in your mouth," he said, I will make my word in your mouth as fire. And this people would. And it shall burn them. We need that. Last section, very quickly. Last section, verses 16 through 18. Is to humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord. That is to repent. Fill their faces with shame that they may seek thy name, O Lord. Let them be confounded and troubled forever. Yea, let them be put to shame and perish, that men may know that thou, whose name alone is Jehovah, art the Most High over all the earth. And again, I'm going to do this very quickly because, for one thing, I think it's very clear. But what's interesting about this is kind of a departure from the norm in the Psalms. You know, the Psalms are highly nationalistic, and while we do read about other nations, there's very little said like this, which is an actual call for them to repent. Now, that's not to say this is a contradiction or even a conflict, but it is interesting. The New Testament, of course, the non-nationalistic church, we have assurances like that. But again, make no mistake about it. There is always the understanding that the Lord is God over all the earth. He's in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him, in Habakkuk chapter 2 and verse 20. But what he is calling upon here is to say, not only do I want them defeated, but I want that defeat to bring about a particular result, that is repentance. In this defeat, in this humiliation, kind of reminds me of what Paul writes in Philippians chapter 2, verses 10 and 11. That at the name of Jesus, every knee shall bow, things in heaven, things on earth, things under the earth, and that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. And the idea there, John talked about that a little bit ago, but he was talking about a different section of the verse than I'm concentrating on. I'm concentrating on the idea that he says everyone will be humbled before God. Either we will be humbled before God voluntarily and be blessed, or be humbled involuntarily and be cursed. I think that what he's saying about these nations is, I'm going to defeat them so that they may voluntarily humble themselves and thus be saved eternally. Either way, if you notice, he says, my name will be glorified. The last verse reads, and it is an answer to that original implied question, why are you being silent in this situation, God? And he says that because now he's not. The time has come. I will speak, I will make my presence known, that men may know that thou, whose name alone is Jehovah, art the Most High over all the earth. Psalm 100 and verse 3. Thou art Lord alone. It is God who made us, not we ourselves. We are his people and the sheep of his pasture.